Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's episode, we're talking with Scott McCloud and asking him how to read a comic book. In 1954, the U.S. Senate convened a hearing on comic books and juvenile delinquency. DC Comics was there, as was Marvel, but the star witness was William M. Gaines, publisher of Entertaining Comics. EC, as it was called, published the biggest and most successful horror titles, Tales from the Crypt, The Haunt of Fear, and The Vault of Horror. They depicted murder, revenge, torture, and were filled with sexual innuendo and lots of O. Henry-esque plot twists. They were gorier than any pop culture medium at the time, and they were beautiful. The Senate committee was hostile. Comics weren't art, witnesses said. They were worthless. They diminished kids' intelligence and had no intrinsic value. But the hearings were built on a contradiction. If comics had no value, they could not have had the power to corrupt. If they could corrupt, then surely they would have been the most successful art in human history. Picasso's Guernica motivates neither war nor peace in its viewers. Michelangelo's David doesn't turn us into nudists. How is it that The Haunt of Fear makes kids bad? It seems to me that the mystical power conferred upon the horror comics was not the reason they wouldn't be classified as art. Instead, it was the refusal to call them art that made them so scary. EC Comics boasted vivid colors and realistic likenesses. The framing, sequencing, and narration were spellbinding. And while the comics weren't graphic by our standards at all, their panels were so emotive that they inspired readers to make adrenaline-filled narrative leaps. If they weren't art, what were they? To be frank, it wasn't the comics themselves that inspired contempt. I think it was that their audience was kids. High culture celebrates artwork, but comics were art play. And if children were the target audience, then surely the grown men who devoted so much time to entertaining them had to be deviants of some form or another. Like the heavy metal bands that faced the ire of the U.S. Senate in the 1980s, and the video game producers who are blamed for gun violence today, horror comics spoke to a generation that wanted to seize creative power from their elders. And true creativity is always transgressive. What the Senate hearings on juvenile delinquency were really about was power. The Senate's desire to control EC was, in a sense, rational. Comics both announce and lead cultural change, and the committee could feel their authority slipping away. Their concerns turned out to be prophetic. Underground comics helped create the language of political and sexual rebellion in the 1960s, and the most important titles from the 70s and 80s challenged norms by exploring immigration, cancer, sexuality, and the Holocaust. Comic storylines had lost all pretense to innocence. And comics also got bigger. The larger book-length volumes had literary aspirations and called themselves graphic novels, trying to distinguish themselves from monthly serials like Wonder Woman. They disassociated themselves from their youngest readers and self-identified as high culture. Their creators wanted respect, and literature for kids is never considered high art, even when it is deserved. If you doubt that, just ask J.K. Rowling how many people think her work is in the same category as Milan Kundera's. I promise you, Harry Potter will outlast the unbearable lightness of being. You have my word on it. But graphic novels' demand for legitimacy ended up distracting from the growing sophistication within the monthlies, whose imagery, narrative structure, and courage were frequently awe-inspiring. Yet the traditional comic book has come to be measured by its market worth, not its aesthetic and experimental value. Readers refer to themselves often as collectors, and their collections are regarded as investments. This does them a terrible disservice. In short, we need to find a way to talk about comics the same way we would opera or sculpture. We need a language and philosophy that respects them, whether they're for kids or adults, whether they're trauma-filled memoirs or 22 pages of silliness. Few people have done more to develop this language than today's guest. His most influential books are themselves comics, but also deeply intellectual texts that begin with the difficult task of defining what a comic is in the first place. With this in mind, on today's show, we're going to have to distinguish between form and content, product and process, purpose and context, and extrinsic and intrinsic value. But our most radical step will be to first acknowledge the Senate's mistake. We will have to approach comics as if they're created for their own sake. EC stood for entertaining comics, but ironically, their power came not from their entertainment or shock value, but from their ability to stand the test of time. The same can be said of them that can be said of Mark Twain, Pablo Picasso, and Marcel Duchamp. They must be judged on their own merits. Comics are art. They always were. The fact that so many don't recognize this may be a condemnation of the audiences, but it says nothing about comics themselves. And now our guest. Scott McCloud may be the world's leading comic book theorist. His two books, Understanding Comics and Making Comics, are impressive as both comics and analytic works. He teaches, consults, and spent 6 years writing and drawing the groundbreaking comic book Zot. Scott, welcome to Why.
Thanks, Jack.
We have pre-recorded the show, so we won't be taking any questions, but if you'd like to send us your comments, tweet us at Why Radio Show, post a comment at facebook.com/Why Radio Show, or visit us live at the chat room at whyradioshow.org. So Scott, when I was younger, I read a lot of Marvel comic books. I left them for a while and came back as an adult to a world of, I don't know, graphic novels, monthlies full of sex and violence, and so many independent publishers that I feel like, I don't know, if Marvel comics weren't making movies, no one would notice them anymore. Are superhero comics, the kind that I grew up with, are they obsolete? Are they outdated?
Superhero comics have gone through a lot of changes, but possibly the biggest change of all was the fact that movies, in some ways, have been doing a better job at them. I think that the beauty of superhero comics in the early days was that authors were able to invent whole worlds out of nothing, and they had no constraints upon them. They had no budgetary constraints, for example. They had only the constraints of their imagination, and artists like Jack Kirby, who created a lot of the characters that we're enjoying now in the movies, could really give free rein to their crazy dreams. Now we're actually approaching an era in which movies may be nearly as flexible. That is, they're nearly as able to capture virtually any dream you might have. Special effects, I think, have actually become quite an art form in their own right. And I have a lot of admiration for a lot of the special effects artists out there, even if they're illustrating stories that aren't necessarily always great stories. I like superhero movies, and I think they're very effective. And now we have to contend with the fact that we have a genuine competitor, because in the early 60s, there was nothing to compete with a great comic by somebody like Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko. There was nothing as imaginative. There was nothing as far-ranging. There was nothing as unhinged in some ways. And that's just not as true as it used to be. But fortunately, comics found other ways to compete because they became far more eclectic, far more far-ranging in the kinds of stories they could tell. They're dabbling in far more styles, and artists are free to talk about a much wider variety of subjects and stories. And also, the faces behind the boards are beginning to diversify a little now too. So as an art form, comics has been growing and maturing and is in very good shape. But the superhero comic, it's got some real competition now.
You know, I it's funny. I hadn't anticipated that answer at all, and it's incredibly compelling. And one of the things that occurs to me when you're saying it is the thing that gives the movies this freedom, the CGI, the special effects, is that just comics writ large? I mean, all of these backgrounds and all this computer stuff, it's just drawings. It's photographs adjusted using computers. Is that – have they co-opted the comic process, or is it different even though it's cartoon-inspired or comic-inspired art?
Well, in some ways, they span the alphabet. You might say that the comics artist gives you the ABC of a dream, and the mind of the reader fills in the rest from C to Z. And up until recently, it was very difficult for people to complete that image. But the completion in the reader's mind was very powerful. There's no question about it. It's just that now that completion is possible. Now we have people who will create effects that are every bit as vivid as what was happening in the mind of the reader. And so, yeah, I think that while I think they're comparable, I think for me, the essence of what made comics had more to do with simply putting one picture after another to tell a story. And that's something that distinguishes them from movies. It's tricky because sometimes we can mistake the genre for the medium. And I think that comics were so closely associated with superheroes for so many years that when superheroes are beginning to dominate moving pictures, we can sometimes think that comics have moved into the movies when, in fact, it's merely the genre that comics gave birth to that's been moving into the movies.
So the question I'm about to ask is, if comics aren't a genre, then what are they? But before I ask that, I want to talk a little bit about this filling in the imagination. We'll talk more about it in a second because you have this whole discussion of what you call closure, which is this process. But you spent a fair amount of time talking about the white spaces in between the pictures, the gutter, the frames around the imagery and how those are manipulated and changed. Is it the presence of that gutter? Is it the presence of that white space that you see in between multiple images that is the kind of thing that you're alluding to now, the one after the other imagery?
Yes. In fact, I think really the essential difference between comics and film is a very simple one, and that is that in comics we place one picture next to each other at the same time, and in film we place one picture after another in the same space at different times. So all we're doing is we're substituting time for space when we move from one medium to the next. That white space between the panels, the reason why I use that as a handy metaphor is because that's where our imagination is activated. Not literally as we're looking at that space, but in the sense of that blink in between images. You may show a picture of, let's say, Charlie Brown in Charles Schulz's Peanuts strip. You may show him picking up a snowball, and in the next panel you may show him throwing that snowball. But you complete that motion in between. You bring it to life. You take those static images and you're what animators would call an in-betweener, in the sense of you complete it and create a fluid motion in your own mind. That's an essential characteristic of comics. Static images in visual sequence is what comics are all about. Now, there are lots of analogies between film and comics. Certainly, a lot of people have pointed out that what happens in the mind when you cut from one scene to another in a film is a little bit like what happens when you cut from one panel to the other in comics. There is a link. But as a lot of people have pointed out, though there are a lot of similarities between film and comics, it's actually the differences where things get really interesting.
This idea of filling in the imagination, it comes to mind. I mentioned the E.C. Horror comic hearing in the monologue, and E.C. Comics has been very influential to me. William Gaines was actually probably, we might talk about this later, the first person I ever considered a personal hero. And he talks about, they're talking about a particular panel in one of the comic books where there's a severed head on a knife. And they hint at the bottom of the neck and the gore, and the senator and the committee says, well, do you show this, that, and that? And William Gaines says, no, if it had been lower, if it had showed, it would be in bad taste, that the what you call the gutter cuts off the gore. And what it sounds like you're suggesting is, in fact, if they had shown more blood, it would have been less powerful. It's the fact that the white space and the imagination is responsible for filling in the imagery is what gives it its power. And so I guess what I'm asking is, to what extent is the absence of information as powerful to the comic experience as the information that the artist and the writer gives?
Well, it's a sliding scale, and if you're working in a medium like comics, you have a choice. You may give the audience quite a lot. You may render things very carefully. You may show moments very closely together, which leaves less up to the imagination. But you can still create effective work if the imagery is powerful, if the choice of what you choose to show is powerful. It can still be a very compelling work. But a lot of the best cartoonists do find that less is more. They find that by just showing a little bit, by pulling those points, those moments a little bit further apart and compelling the reader to do more work along the lines of what you're just describing, that can be very effective. And there are two kinds of connections as well. There's moment-to-moment connections, that is, taking one panel and imagining what happens between. And then there's also the fact that when we draw a panel, when we put a rectangle around a scene in comics, we're also asking the reader to imagine the world beyond that rectangle. We're not saying that this is the entire world. We're saying this is a window into the world. And that's what Gaines was dealing with when they were discussing that cover.
So then let's start the conversation at the beginning. You say in the book that something like a single panel Far Side or a Family Circus is not a comic. And I inadvertently in an early comment used the word cartoon instead of comic and then corrected myself. What is a comic? What isn't a comic? And how important is this definition to the conversation that we're having?
Well, interestingly, to start, I actually would describe something like the Far Side of the Family Circus as cartoons. They're cartoonists who make them. And I think often if you would ask the people who make single panel pieces in the newspaper, they would describe themselves as cartoonists. They would talk about it as maybe a cartoon panel. They might use the word comic. And of course, comics, it's the comics page, right? So that the word can be just a catch-all for everything on the comics page. And, you know, I have no trouble with that. When I offered my definition of comics, I was adding a definition to the dictionary. I wasn't attempting to wipe away the old ones. So if you wanted to use the word comics to merely describe the stapled four-color stories of, you know, 24 pages long with two guys in skin-tight costumes beating the crap out of each other, that's fine. Those are comics. That's one meaning of the word. But I was saying that in addition to that, in addition to the comic strips and the comic books and the things that we're familiar with, there was also this overarching idea of putting one picture after another. And as you mentioned, I had to exclude single panels. But I think the first thing to recognize is the fact that that's no disrespect to cartoonists, to those who use a cartoon style, because I use the word cartoon to describe the style of drawing, the style of image making. There's no disrespect in saying that they're not making comics. They're still cartoonists, and there's an incredibly proud tradition of cartoonists in America, at least as proud as the tradition of comic artists. But the important thing wasn't so much which small examples were sort of sliced off when I drew that boundary around my definition. The purpose of the definition wasn't about excluding work. The purpose was to include work. And I actually think that there were a lot of things that we didn't think of as comics that really were comics. And the longer I look at them and analyze them over the years, the more certain I am in the conviction that we should consider certain other works to be comics.
So what is that definition, since the readers haven't read the book? It involves sequential art. What does that mean, and what's the definition you've settled on?
Yeah, the simple definition is sequential art, and that's usually all you'll need. But sooner or later, somebody comes along and says, animation is sequential art, and then you have to trot out the longer definition. The longer one I cobbled together was juxtapose pictorial and other images in deliberate sequence. I'm not suggesting that we replace any of the words that we use in regularly.
You really are a philosopher. You know that if a sentence like that is useful to you, we both hang out in the same bar.
it helps you be more specific.
So would you say that again, though, so that everyone can hear it one more time?
Sure. Juxtaposed pictorial and other images in deliberate sequence. Really, putting a picture down on a page or a screen and putting another picture next to it and saying, these are not two pictures next to each other. This is one moment. And then the next moment. It's a kind of temporal map. You're mapping time. And if you think about it, that's unique among the art forms. Prose, movies, theater, all of these things, all of these narrative art forms, it's always now in those art forms. Only in comics do you rise above that landscape of time that we live in. And you're no longer on that treadmill of now because you suddenly see past, present, and future all around you. It's a very unique form in that respect. You're creating a map of time. And it's a kind of topsight that no other art form provides.
This was for me, I think, the most groundbreaking is the wrong word, but for me the biggest insight that I got from reading your stuff, which is that it never occurred to me that the fundamental concern of comics is playing with time. And yet you spend a fair amount of time talking about how juxtaposing different frames at different intervals completely changes the story. So why don't you talk a little bit about Japanese tradition and how they use a very slow notion of time and compared with other things. Why is time this central idea in sequential art?
Well, one of the first things I noticed when I began to break it down that way was, as you mentioned, there are different ways of approaching time in comics. And I especially noticed a big difference between American and Japanese comics. Thing is, when you're putting those two panels together, the panels can have any kind of pair of moments at all. I could show you somebody holding a coffee cup an inch above a counter and follow it by somebody holding a coffee cup half an inch above a counter. Well, that's nearly film, right? That's nearly what you'd get if you ripped an old school film reel out of the projector. You would see something like that where the progressions were extremely small. But then again, I could show panel one, I could show you a bunch of dinosaurs cavorting, and then in panel two, I could show you an Arco station pumping gas. Now, there are two things about that. Number one, we've just jumped many millions of years. But number two, your mind is so craving for meaning that you're going to find a connection. And I'm sure anyone who just heard that found that connection. The beauty is that even randomly combined pictures will compel people to find some kind of narrative connection. And so with that tremendous flexibility of connecting points in time, you have a lot of choices. And in American comics, what we really favor is actions. We like showing an action in panel one, a different action in panel two, a different action in panel three. Well, we still do that in comics in Japan and Europe, but in Japan, there's another kind of connection that we didn't see much in America for many years. And that was what I called aspect-to-aspect combinations, where you would show just an aspect of an idea or a scene in panel one, and then another aspect in panel two, another aspect in panel three. So, for instance, I'm sitting in a radio studio right now, and I have an engineer sitting here. He might be in panel one. Then you might see a clock on the wall in panel two. Then you might see a pen lying on a counter in panel three. Well, what you're saying is not that engineer happened, then clock happened, then pen happened, right? What you're saying is that you've cast a roving eye upon the world. You're showing just fragments of experience, and now it's up to the reader to stitch those together into an environment, a world, an experience. And that can be very powerful because the act of stitching it together makes you a participant in the act of perception.
One of the things that I think comics does not get credit for is how active of an audience it has to have. People think of comics as a passive medium that you're just sort of looking at things and you're entertained. But a lot of what you argue is that the audience has to be directly involved and has to put their own imagination and their own interpretation in there or it doesn't work. When we come back from the break, I want to ask you about that. And I want to ask you about the central problem that I think a lot of people have when they re-encounter comics as an adult, which is what do they look at first? But before we do that, we'll take a break. You're listening to Scott McCloud and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this. Thank you.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Scott McCloud about how to read a comic book. And I mentioned earlier in the show that I sort of took some time off of reading comic books and that I rediscovered them. And to a certain extent, that happened when I had a daughter and she took an interest in comic books. But if I'm being really honest, it's only really happened with any intensity in the last year. And when I first picked up the comic books again, I was encouraged by a friend. I thought, well, I'm old and I'm going to be looking for more sophistication than it has, and it'll be a throwback to my childhood. Of course, the first thing was they were a lot more sophisticated than I remembered, and they were much more satisfying than I remembered. But the other thing I didn't realize is that because I had gotten old, my eyesight had gotten really bad. This I knew, but it didn't occur to me that when I picked up a traditional comic book, a 31-page volume, the same basic size, I couldn't read the text anymore. And so my friend showed me an iPad, a Marvel Comics reader, and then another sort of generic one called iComics that allowed me to focus on a single panel and zoom in. And suddenly I could read the text with a lot more clarity, and it wasn't stressful, and I didn't have to make an effort, and I could really enjoy it. But the process of looking at the digital reader means that I'm constantly zooming in and zooming out. And I have this almost an existential crisis when I read, which is I don't know which to start with. Do I start with the full page and get an overall vision of it and then zoom into the panel? Or do I, as the reader wants me to do, focus on a panel and then zoom out to see how it connects? And so I say that, Scott, to ask you, when you open a comic book, what do you look at first? Do you look at the whole page? Do you look at a panel? Do you look at the picture? Do you look at the words? I'm an old guy, and it takes more effort to read and to see than it did when I was 16. Is that taking away from the experience, or is that just allowing me to have another kind of emphasis that brings a whole different experience?
I do think that for me, one of the essential qualities of comics is how panels interrelate. That is, how you see them in a display, in a page, in relationship to each other. If you take an extreme opposite case, that would be just showing one panel at a time, not even zooming, but simply maybe hitting a space bar and having a new panel replace the old one. Well, if you did that, you'd actually be approaching something a little bit more like film or a slideshow. You'd be losing one of the unique qualities of comics, that temporal map quality. And while that might not necessarily impinge on the reading experience, it might conceivably still be enjoyable if the story is good, if the words are good, if the pictures are good. Nevertheless, you might think to yourself, well, this is fun, but maybe a movie would be more fun, right? Maybe a TV show would be more fun because this is just like a sort of a poor man's TV show, right? I do think that showing multiple panels is part of what makes comics comics. And having each narrative art form occupy a slightly different aesthetic space, it's useful. You don't necessarily want each art form to be just striving to be some version of motion pictures, to be some version of television. If everything is just striving to be something other than what it is, then you're experiencing that narrative world through the same lens again and again. I think it's very important that everything from poetry to comics to TV to movies to books to theater approach the world, reproduce the world, dramatize the world from a different viewpoint. Because when you do that, we can re-enter the world that we live in through enough different vantage points that we can triangulate the shape of the world that we live in. And it triangulates our experience as human beings. And that's one of the great values of having different forms of narrative work. is that triangulation. So I'm always very suspicious of things that try to make comics come alive in a digital form where they're really just like movies. And there are examples of that. There are these motion comics, which are essentially panning around individual comics panels one at a time with soundtracks and music. They're really just trying to be movies. And to me, there's no point in it. But another thing that you mentioned, of course, is the way in which we're showing comics digitally now with the zooming. That solved a very important problem for you. You could read the text, which is a fundamental problem. In the early days of the web, I suggested a lot of digital forms for comics, and I was extremely excited about that. But one of the first things you have to do is just get rid of the idea of the page. And a lot of these mobile comics, they don't bother to get rid of the idea of the page. So what they'll do is you'll be scrolling and moving and panning around a single page, but then you have to turn to the next page. To me, there's no point because the page is an artifact of print. Might as well have the whole thing on just one big scroll.
I do find – I mean, I love my iPad, and I like the fact that I can read it better, but I also have – and I'm just going to keep bringing this up, and I apologize. I also have this anthology of EC horror comic books that's one of these huge oversized books. And so the page has been increased 3 or 4 times. And I can have the iPad on my lap in bed and read it, and it's fine. But if I'm sitting on bed with this massive thing that allows me to see the whole page of the EC comics, I just love that. It's so much more fun, and I think that's part of what you're talking about, which is – This thing as a whole that reproduces the original experience. But then, of course, I still have a decision to make. And the decision is, what do I look at first, the pictures or do I look at the words? Is there a right way to do that? When there is the mixed – there are comics that just have pictures, of course, which I'll talk about in a second. But is there a proper way to approach that? Do you look at the picture and then read the words, or do you read the words and then look at the picture?
Well, you have to follow your own passion as a reader, of course. And, you know, whichever way of experiencing comics works for you, you go with it. You don't necessarily question it. But there are two different aspects to your question. I mean, first, we were talking about that those oversized EC volumes. You know, I'm getting older myself, and my eyesight isn't quite what it used to be. I appreciate having lettering that I can read. But when we were looking at the prospect of digital comics, I first entered into that idea from the vantage point of somebody who is anticipating things like VR coming into it.
VR being virtual reality.
That's right, yeah. And in my ideal scenario, there would be endless, you know, zooming and panning would be fine. I mean, you could just go in to comics all you liked, you know, get as close or as far as you like, but think of them as a single, almost physical canvas, you know, on which the panels were all arranged. And so if you wanted to take a closer look at something, you could, because it would just have a physicality to it and an all-at-onceness to it. But to the question of words versus pictures and the question of panels versus pages. You see, there were really three aspects to your question. I think that there's – for panels versus pages, I think that there's a kind of double-track experience going on where what happens is when you land in the story, you're going from panel to panel to panel to panel, and each panel becomes the world. That is, everything else kind of fades a little. It becomes backgrounded. And that single panel that you're reading at any given time, that's activated and becomes now. But the rest of it still exists in your peripheral vision. You still see the rest of it. And you still see it embedded in there. And I think that creates an aesthetic background experience that colors the experience of reading comics in a way that nothing else does. And then to the third part of your question, which is words and pictures, I think that we experience, you know, again, there's no right way, whether looking at pictures or looking at the words. I think every comics writer hopes that you're going to read all their words. There was one comics critic once many years ago who referred to captions as little boxes and admitted that he never read them. But you know, ideally, it's a dance. It's an interdependent dance between words and pictures. and the two of them really should not hog the stage. And I think that sometimes you have a problem when you have a separate writer and a separate artist. Sometimes you'll have this writer versus artist problem that both of them are trying to show off. And that never works well. I think both have to have a certain amount of humility, and the pictures have to let the words do the talking sometime. The words have to let the pictures do the talking sometime. When that works, then you won't have to decide which one to experience, because you'll be experiencing them both in an interdependent way, in an organic way, and in a way that you don't even notice, because what you're really experiencing is just story.
You mentioned in the book that in understanding comics that there's often a conflict between also the colorist and the inker, that when the people who are collaborating are calling for too much attention to their individual work, that also destroys the process. That struck me because the only conversation I ever recall about inkers is in Kevin Smith's movie Chasing Amy, where one of the characters calls the inker in the comic book a tracer. What do you do for a living? You trace for a living. And he's very, very offended by that. How visible is it to people who don't know what's going on when the collaborators, if there are multiple collaborators, are in conflict? Is that inherent in the product and someone can detect it? Or do you really have to have a sense of what's happening before you can see that conflict?
Well, the breakdown of labor in comics is a product of the industry, not the art form. And, you know, it's always important to remember that it wasn't always the way of it. In the early comic strips in the early 20th century in America, it was customary for one person to do the whole job. And in graphic novels and a lot of alternative comics and web comics, that's still true. You still often have just one person creating the whole universe. But when superhero comics came along and they became a hit, and there was this demand to churn out issue after issue after issue on a regular schedule, it became useful to break apart the writer and the artist. And you had that from the very beginning in comic books. You had Siegel and Shuster, who created Superman. They were a writer and artist team. And, of course, we have the famous team of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby in Marvel Comics. But then they broke it down further because they found that maybe there was a penciler who was especially popular, and it was better to have multiple inkers on their work so they could be drawing two books a month instead of just one, or maybe even three. In the case of Kirby, Kirby could draw a comic book in an afternoon while watching TV on his lap board and talking to fans. He was incredibly fast. But that whole mass-produced culture, that was something that grew out of the industry as much as it grew out of the art form. And there are many of us who felt that simply saying the words penciler and inker in a way, it reduced them to just skills rather than art. And I think many of us wanted to sort of pull back on that, maybe push back on that rather, and encourage people to just look at it as an art form all at once. And as I say, you know, when you break it down very quickly, you have one part of the process maybe competing with the other part of the process. And that integration between words and pictures especially, that sometimes breaks down. And instead, you just have two different creative individuals showing off and trying to outshine each other, which doesn't result in great work.
And I want to revisit the panel discussion because I want to talk about how they're organized. But before I do that, you mentioned that when you have this mass production, it tends to reduce things to skills rather than art. And what has struck me, particularly with web art, is that there are these very successful comics that, for lack of a better term, have bad artists. And what I mean by that is not the comics aren't wonderful, but that the skill level, the draftsmanship, what artists call, isn't there. So you have XKCD, which is a very, very well-loved comic strip that has just stick figures. And then you get very, very stylized cartoonists who are just very basic drawings. My own daughter has a comic strip that she started on Instagram, and she does these peg figures. How separate is the drafting skills of the artist to the the medium of comics and is something that is hyper-realistic or super well-drawn, almost a different animal than something like XKCD or Savage Chickens, which is not usually sequential anyway. Is that a whole different animal, or is it not about the individual skill level but about something more amorphous and abstract?
Well, you know, really what we're talking about is the cult of the professional, the whole idea of professional standards. This was something that made a lot of sense back in the days when the industry was this fortress that where you had to cross the moat and you had to be let in at the gate. Well, all of a sudden, the hordes have come in and anybody can put their work online. And the whole idea of entry-level skills is dead. Well, as a professional artist, I'm a beneficiary of the cult of the professional, and I say to hell with it. I'm cheering on the hordes. I'm saying tear it all down. It was a scam. It made no sense at all. If you can create a wonderful experience in the mind of the viewer, if you can make me laugh, if you can tell an interesting story, if you can blow my mind with some fascinating insights the way that Randall Monroe does in XKCD, go for it. And if you can do it with a stick figure, all the better. If you can do it with a stick figure that doesn't even have a face, which is what Randall Monroe does, then my hat's off to you. I think it's wonderful. And also one of the interesting side effects of that is people who do come online and who are doing work that may be rough, that may be unskilled – once they get their audience, they keep learning, and they often get better. And if you look at a lot of popular webcomics especially, you'll find when you go back in the archives that when they started out, they had far fewer skills and that they gained them over time.
And I'm going to ask you a direct question about that in just a second. But first, is what you're describing the analog to the classical trained and outsider art is what's happening, a sort of democratization of the comics that comes from the internet? Is that really just untrained people doing it in the same way that now galleries and collectors think is incredibly valuable? They just call it this other category. Are these people outsider artists, or is it not analogous?
I would say it's only peripherally analogous, for the simple reason that when all the walls are gone, there is no outside. And so the whole notion of outsider art, you know, stipulates that there has to be some kind of structure on the inside. There is no inside. There is no outside. Everybody's just competing in the same arena. And the only measure of their success is in the genuine reactions of their audience. And you never know when they're going to get that audience, how they're going to get it, and who they're going to be. But at the end of the day, you simply add up the genuine sensations you were able to generate, and that's all that matters. We're all competing on the exact same playing field. And I like that. I think it's good.
So this then is going to the fine artists who listen to the show and who I know are shouting in my brain, but there have to be standards. There have to be objective standards. There has to be something that shows that you aren't just popular, but you're good. So is the standard of good here that you're talking about simply audience reaction? Is it a rhetorical problem, for lack of a better term? Is it popularity? What counts as good, and is part of what you're describing just the eratification of sort of objective standard of what a good comic is?
Well, standards have not disappeared. The standards still exist, and there are as many as there ever were. But they are after-the-fact standards. They are standards being applied by discriminating viewers and not-so-discriminating viewers based on their own standards, based on their own taste, and based on communal standards as well. And in some ways, they're just as valuable, and in many cases, they're even just as rigid or just as specifically applied. But the difference is that those standards of judgment are no longer able to prevent somebody from reaching their audience. That was the norm in the days when all of these things had to be shipped from state to state and driven in trucks and put on shelves, and when things had to be signed off on by publishers, is that artists did not compete for eyeballs. They didn't compete for their audience. Somebody decided along the way, in fact, several somebodies would decide along the way, if they could reach an audience at all or if they were to be buried forever. Buried because their work didn't look quite like what was popular on the stands. Buried because maybe they were the wrong gender. Buried maybe because they weren't telling the kinds of stories people were used to, or they didn't look the way the other people who got jobs were looked. You know, that was how standards were applied. They were applied at the gate. But there's nothing to stop us from applying those standards once the work lands in the public arena. And I think that's a much better distribution of the power of art.
And is this why mainstream imprints and publishers look a certain way and the indies look a different way? I mean, you look now at Supergirl and the other female superheroes, and they are buxom beyond belief. And Supergirl went through this period of her and everyone else midriff showing and just the most not just misogynist, that's the wrong word, but just the most exploitative, sexploitative use of the characters. And you certainly see graphic sexuality in many indie comics, but you don't see as dominant this kind of picture. Is that what's happening, that the editors, that the publishers, they had a sense of what sold to this certain demographic and that's what they were going to maximize, and everyone else could just get out of the office, they wouldn't talk to them?
Oh, Jack, it's a tempest in a teapot. You know, we're talking about what's happening at Marvel and DC as if that is comics. But in fact, those are just two companies that no longer have the influence that they used to. In the comics world, they do. In the movie world, they have tremendous influence.
Which is too bad in DC's case.
Yeah.
Because they're terrible.
They are pretty bad. But what's going on in the superhero comics, really we have to accept the fact that those are no longer the mainstream in a lot of ways. Because there's a whole generation of readers that just roll their eyes at the kind of things you were just describing. In fact, in all likelihood, they weren't even aware that that was happening, because instead they're reading the work of, you know, great graphic novelists, or they're reading this tremendous revolution in kids' comics that are coming out now. I mean, the best-selling cartoonists in America are making kids' comics, and that stuff is sensitive and progressive. Not at all exploitive in terms of you know, things like costume details and whatnot. They're often telling stories about 14 and 15-year-olds anyway. And they're made primarily by women. Especially there's one in particular, Raina Telgemeier, who comes up a lot in these discussions. And she sold millions of copies of her comics. And they're just comics about ordinary life, about high school drama clubs or middle school drama clubs. Or her own autobiographical adventure when she had some dental problems because she fell and knocked a couple of teeth back. She has a whole graphic novel just about that, and the thing has reached a million readers. And that's the mainstream now. So I think that, you know, often the latest shenanigans, you know, happening in the pages of a Marvel and DC comic, sometimes we can mistake that for the state of comics. But in fact, that's merely the state of this shrinking kingdom that used to be the world.
My friend who initiated my return to comics turned me on to a series called Paper Girls, which is these group of high school and late middle school girls who start a paper route, and then stuff happens, which I'm not going to ruin it. And I read it, and first of all, I loved it. And second of all, I could have cried because it was just – so real, and so the characters, I don't even know the language that isn't going to sound silly, cliche, but they were strong, they were real, they were thick, they were just people. And this was one of the things, one of the first comics that I gave to my daughter that wasn't, you know, my old remnants of my old collection, because she doesn't want to read EC and she doesn't want to read Mad Magazine. So that I said, read this. This is awesome. And And I think that's an example of that. And I guess I am habituated to think that the standard is the Marvel and the DC. And even though I look at that standard with contempt, I still think of it as the default. And I guess part of what you're suggesting is it's not the default anymore. It's actually just hanging on.
Well, this is really what we're talking around here is the question of art form versus genre, or medium versus genre. And, you know, we finally come to the point where we realize that there's this art form that contained a genre known as superheroes, and now it's finally expanded well beyond that. And you were just describing something that's not really superheroes. It's a genre comic in the sense that it has some fantasy elements and all. Paper Girls does. But there's this tremendous distribution of comics that are simply outside of that original genre of superheroes. And the diversity right now, you know, there are autobiographical comics, there are nonfiction comics where people explain things the way I do in my books. There are still superhero comics, and there are actually some pretty good superhero comics out there. There are kids comics, fantasy comics, and we also still have a pretty robust readership for comics from abroad, especially from Japan. And Japan especially pioneered this idea that there can be a comic for virtually everybody. But we're getting closer to that in the States. You know, webcomics have definitely pushed the envelope in that regard. There are webcomics for many, many different interests. And the nice thing is that they don't have to compete for shelf space. They can come online, and people who are interested in whatever subject they're about will find them, whereas before there wasn't any place to shelve them between, you know, the Invisibles and the Incredible Hulk or whatever.
So you have this comic that you worked on for 6 years. I forget how many issues, Zot. And I guess the first question I'm going to ask about it is it called Zot because your name is Scott? But the second
– No, the character was originally a robot, and he was named Bot. And then when I made him human, my friend Kurt Busick, who also writes comics now – though we were in school at the time, he suggested calling him Zot instead of Bot. So that's how we got the name.
All right. I will believe that since you told it to me. So I look at the issues. If someone looks at the issues and someone sees the first issue and, let's say, the middlemost issue and the final issue, other than the fact that they started in color and then ended up in black and white, which I'm curious why you do that – what would you say is visibly different at those three points in the series? How do you, as an artist, as a creator, as someone with a vision, what's different at those points, and how would you like the reader to experience those differences?
Well, I began Zot, which is, as you say, it was my first comic, back in 1983. I was 23 years old. Or actually, it was first published in 84, but I was 23. And I finished it up when I was about 30. And, you know, it shows my evolution as an artist. I have a lot of different interests. So there were actually, even though it was ostensibly a superhero comic, I was influenced by American avant-garde comics, by European comics, by Japanese comics. I was just looking at just about everything in those days. And as it progressed and went through its black and white phase, which was partially influenced by manga, by Japanese comics, I think I was becoming restless because I was finding that though I was able to tell a lot of different kinds of stories, at the same time I felt like I was being a little weighed down by the genre. And the kinds of stories I wanted to tell were starting to go a little beyond the package of the original comic. I still like Zot, but it matured, it became softer, it became more about real life, and then towards the end, I think it showed the strains in me that I wanted to move on. I wanted to do a different kind of a thing. One of the things I wanted to do was understanding comics. I wanted to do this big book about comics, which had been rolling around in my head, and I had just started a long arc of stories in Zot. When I realized, I need to do this book now, and I knew I'd have to wait a year, and it was painful. But yeah, you see an artist growing, and then you see an artist straining wanting to break out of the shackles. And that's sort of that diary of my artistic progression through that. But we had a lot of fun. I loved my audience. And I actually would like to bring Zot back someday, probably in another form, because I'm so restless. I'm always sort of reinventing how I make things. I like a lot of the characters. I think they're a lot of fun. And again, I do think that superheroes is a legitimate genre. I think you can have a lot of fun with superheroes. One of my favorite comics, Scott Pilgrim, was basically a superhero comic.
You in the very end of Understanding Comics, you tell a story about how a comic artist sort of grows, and then what you do is and then the person is satisfied with this level and then stays, and then you go move on to the another one who moves up to the level and moves up to the another level until there's sort of mastery and influence and all of that. Is that your story of Zot to a certain extent? Is the depiction that you offer to your readers of the growth of a comic artist as from the perspective of artist maturity, is that representative of your experience, or is that representative of your experience? Did you find that Zot, among other things, was just pushing you to say, I keep moving past what I can do, and so I'm striving for something else, and I need to be able to articulate what that is?
Well, I think almost any artist has a kind of progression in their early career of moving from surface to core. And that was certainly something that happened with me and Zot. And that is that the very first approach that you make to an art form is usually surface. You're really attracted to something that looks pretty or cool looking, and you want to try to reproduce that surface. The first drawings or paintings that you might create are going to be probably imitating somebody whose work you really admire. And that was certainly true of me in the very beginning when I was like 15 years old. But then a little bit later, you start to see that just under the surface, there's a certain amount of structure and craft. There's a kind of construction to the work, something that isn't necessarily viewable on the surface, but that affects how the work is put together. Like, for instance, you may like the way somebody renders a drawing of a figure, but you realize, oh, I got to learn my anatomy. I got to figure out how these limbs connect, that kind of thing. And then a little while later, you might find that there's a deeper structure underneath that, a kind of architecture of the art form that you need to learn as well. And it's not just about putting one limb next to each other, not just connecting the limbs, but it's also about the whole strategy of constructing the scenarios, arranging things in space, that sort of thing. And then after a while, you realize that everything you like is maybe in one particular idiom, one particular genre, and that there's a broader world out there. And then beyond that, you may finally arrive at the real core questions of any art form, which is, what is it I want to say, and why is it I want to say it in this form? And those really, going backwards in a lot of ways, are what I wound up describing as the six steps, which was idea, form, idiom, structure, craft, and surface. And I realized that a lot of times artists begin at the surface and have to burrow down to the core. And a lot of young artists kind of give up. They never really quite get to the center. They never quite figure out what they want to say. They never quite figure out why they want to say it. And that was something that I wanted to get to. And that's something in many ways I'm still grappling with, because that's a lifelong quest, figuring out what you want to say and how you want to say it.
I'm going to say something stupid, and I apologize, but everything you're describing is just art. I mean, in the sense that you're describing the life of an artist, you're describing the process of mastery, of pushing the boundaries, of trying to move the discourse forward and the tradition forward. So, what is it that makes people so resistant to treating comics as an art in and of itself? Why is it commercialism? Is it the kids, as I suggested in the monologue? In your opinion, where does this resistance come from? Because everything you describe is, in a certain sense, indistinguishable from every other conversation with an artist I've had on the show, in my life. It's, you know, it's a universal, and I don't mean that negatively, right? It's a universal experience that's tremendously wonderful to dive into. So where's the resistance?
Well, I think it comes down to the original sin, which is what I think of as the heaven or hell conundrum. The idea that an art form can be either an art or not an art. The idea that any person's endeavor can be art or not art. You know, if you postulate that it's binary like that, then there's got to be some dividing line, right? There's got to be some moment that, oh, but for that one single brushstroke, this might have been art, but I guess it isn't now. You know, I don't think art is an either-or proposition. I think there's a little art in nearly everything we do. I think that some endeavors are more thoroughly in that camp. They're more thoroughly in the realm of self-expression. But art, at the end of the day, for me, is just that branch of human activities that doesn't grow out of our twin instincts for survival or reproduction. That is, the things that are not about, they're not about social advancement, they're not about making money, it's not about, you know, improving your station in life. It's about the thing itself. And so, you know, effectively what I'm saying is that art is useless, which I think is a defensible statement. I think the thing that truly makes it art is what makes it useless. And that glorious uselessness is the way that people step out of that lockstep parade of survival and reproduction that characterizes that evolutionary mandate. So in other words, it's something that we're rising above that simple march of instinct. Because if you look at it, survival and reproduction, actually the tendrils that grow out of the branches that grow out of that and the branches that grow out of those branches, they infect a lot of what we do. But when you remove that, there's still time left in the day to just make stuff, to just bang rocks on other rocks, to tap our feet, or to make some useless flourish at the assembly line. There's something that we're doing that has no purpose but pleases us in and of itself. That's art. And there's a little art in every comic. There's a little art in every movie. There's a little art in every novel, in every play, but there's also a little of those other things too. The things that we do for practical reasons, the things we do because we think the market will accept them. There's a little art in everything, and there's a little not art in everything. And the proportions, they vary tremendously. And certainly we can look at somebody like Van Gogh and we can say that when he sat down to paint, or probably stood up, come to think of it, that guy probably had very little in mind except the thing itself. He had very little concern for his own well-being. And some would call it art and some would call it madness, but, you know, fits my definition.
If I could take Wire Radio and transform it into sequential panels right now, I would juxtapose what you just said with an episode that we had about 6 months ago called Why Did Homo Sapiens Evolve Into Artists? In which we had an evolutionary biologist talk about the evolutionary function of art. And he suggested, and I recommend if people haven't listened to it that they should. It was a great show and he was wonderful, that what art does evolutionary is create alternative possibilities. That what mm-hmm. art does is say, okay, I'm not surviving right now. I'm not in this survival mode. So how might the world be otherwise? Mm-hmm. And I think that's helping me understand a little bit the role of panels, because panels are panel three does not have to follow from panel two, right? It's a choice. It's the artist's choice. And so then the reader has to make that connection, the causal connection or the temporal connection between panel two and panel three. And so the art in part and I'm leading to a question, but the art in part is the artist figuring out what are the possibilities, what could three be, and what's believable, and what pursues my story. And so then the question I have for you is, and I promised earlier that I would come back to this, one of the big differences that you see from the early Superman, even the EC comics, and then later, I think the Jack Kirby comics, and then even later on, are the way that panels change. At first, they were just a grid that there were, you know, a couple on first column, second column, third column, new page, first column, second. But then there were oddly shaped panels. And then if you look at Art Spiegelman's Mouse, the flow from one panel to another isn't always clear which direction you go. And sometimes you have whole images with a panel inside. How much is, because this is one of the defining aspects of the genre, how much is the shape and order of the panel an essential component of the narrative? And I don't mean, I think the way that it's, the question sounds is do you have to move from one to the other? Obviously but the decision to make a panel a shape, the decision to make a panel in a different location, can you determine the narrative structure? Can you determine the content? Do you know something about the story by just looking at the panel shapes and the way that they're arranged without even looking at the art and the content within the panel?
Yeah, if you took all of the artwork out of a page of comics or several pages of comics, several different kinds of comics, I bet a lot of readers could actually identify what you were looking at, you know, whether you're looking at a mid-60s superhero comic or you're looking at Mouse or you're looking at, you know, something else. To some extent, yeah, it's a giveaway. Although you can have wildly different comics that all, for instance, use the six-panel grid. 2x3 is pretty common. But I have to go back to something you said earlier that was interesting. You're talking about the reader having to interpret it one way or another. Of course, one of the beauties of comics is the reader doesn't have to do anything. There's nothing to prevent the reader from reading it backwards or from skipping all around the page. It's actually a contract. It's actually a gentleman's agreement between the reader, or a woman's agreement between the reader and the artist as to what order you're going to go in. And there's a kind of protocol to it. And sometimes when a genre becomes a little overly ripe, when a genre has become a little more insular, as superhero comics were in, let's say, the late 90s, sometimes that protocol becomes a little exotic, and it's actually quite difficult to know where to go unless you're part of the initiated. And, a lot of us artists, we were kind of pushing back against that because we wanted comics to be more easily read by newcomers because we wanted new readers in those days. We got them, fortunately, because we made some really great comics. But we as a community, not me personally. But, I think that to some extent it's a giveaway. To some extent panel shapes really affect the work. Although I've got to say that of all the decisions when you create a comic – as important as panel shape is, as important as how well the work is drawn, as important as, you know, your skill in putting words together is, the most powerful thing of all is simply what you decide to show. That is, the choice of story and the choice of what kinds of things you want to show to the reader. Those are often the most powerful, even if the drawings aren't always as slick. It's the choice of what goes in those panels that makes the most powerful impact, I think, on the reader.
Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe give us some examples, in part because we skimmed over in the beginning of the episode of this idea of closure, which was the way that the imagination fills in the gaps between the panels and also outside the frame. And I think that's really important, and I think I didn't do it – I think I did a disservice by going over it too quickly. I think this is a good place to revisit. So what mm-hmm. do you have in mind, and what are good examples that maybe you can describe that indicate what you mean by what you decide to show?
Well, first of all, we should say the word closure goes back to Gestalt psychology. That notion of filling in the gaps, you know, the idea that, you know, evolutionarily speaking, it's pretty useful that we can see a line that's broken up and we can kind of complete it in our minds. You know, when you have a snake in the grass, you don't want to think of it as many little segments of a snake. You want to be able to understand that's a real snake and that it's heading for you. And so it's a compulsion. One of the best things about that compulsion is it's so powerful that if I cut out 10,000 photos and put them in a giant pile and you just pick two randomly and place them on a table, your sort of narrative imagination would immediately find some kind of connection. So the power of closure, it's virtually limitless. You know, even completely random, non-sequitorial combinations, you're going to find some kind of connection. So if you've got that strong an ally on the part of the reader, you should take advantage of it. And many artists do. Many artists, you know, will have something about to happen and then just skip to the scene thereafter. And we know that an action took place, that something happened in between the two. But, you know, I think that it may be underused. I think that in many respects, probably I could go through the average comic and I could kill maybe 40 panels and the story would not be any worse for it. I tried to do that in my own work. My editor once wisely suggested as an exercise that I try just cutting my story in half and see if I can still have a coherent story. I'm sure that I could. So that's, you know, finding those wider connections is definitely a worthwhile challenge for comics artists. And I think it's unfinished business. I think a lot of us probably spell it out maybe a little bit more than we need to. I know that certainly in terms of words, the tradition back in the 60s in a lot of those classic Marvel comics, the tradition was to spell everything out. And you'd often have in the captions, you'd have just a restatement of what was already happening in the drawings, which seemed a bit criminal, especially when the drawings were pretty good, as they often were.
One of our listeners had written me in advance, David, to ask about the old classic illustrated comic books, which I had some, and then you mentioned in passing in Understanding Comics. The thing about the classics illustrated was that they took these books and they just converted into comics. David wanted to know whatever happened to them. The question that I have, in addition to that, is that a – I'm really trying to figure out how to ask this question. Is that a second-tier comic effort? And what I mean by that is you're taking something else's work and you're putting it into comics, but – it's not the same thing as the creators of Saga making this, you know, many-year epic journey that is entirely in their own imagination. It's just derivative, I guess, would be the word. Or does something like Classics Illustrated just – it's just another project and it's either good or not and it has as much artistic value as something else?
Actually, I like your term. I'm going to go with second-tier effort. Yeah, I think that definitely describes the original Classics Illustrated, which were illustrated cliff notes. Let's be honest about this. Their whole existence was predicated on kids wanting to pass the test and not wanting to have to read Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Right. So they would, you know, yank out the 20-page, you know, color version that they could read in 15 minutes, and then hopefully they could pass the test. And obviously it's, you know, it doesn't speak well of the art form that the art form's purpose was merely to be a cheap, quick, dirty, crude way of getting your homework done. But the notion of adapting classic works, well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, movies adapt classic works, and sometimes they can create quite compelling art in their own right, sometimes even better than the original. And that does exist in comics. But, You see, the key word is illustrated. Classics Illustrated took this idea that here's the classic as this primary work, and now we're merely going to illustrate it. Now we're going to decorate it with our pictures. And instead, what you really want is classics visualized. You want a story that's been made visual and really thought through on every level. You know, as an example of that, I think there are some good examples, and one of them would be City of Glass, which is one of the most teachable comics that I've ever encountered. I teach comics sometimes, and we've used that in a sort of book club segment. City of Glass is an adaptation of the short story by Paul Auster, and it's put together by Paul Krasik and David Mazzucchelli, a couple of very talented folks. And they made a slim graphic novella, if you like, that really brought out all the wonderful qualities of the original story, but it really adapted them into a different form, and it uses the form of comics in a very strong, compelling way and creates sensations that were not present in the original work but are very harmonious with the original work. Just absolutely terrific. But we're not just going to illustrate classics. I really think we have to visualize them.
So feeding off this word visual and knowing that we're wrapping up soon, in understanding comics, you have this whole discussion about images versus icons and how, in a certain sense, if you simplify a face, it becomes more universal. And this is one of the ways that you introduce comics. It's really fascinating, and I encourage readers to look at it. And now I know you are working on a large-scale project that it sounds like it isn't limited to comics per se. It's a work on visual communication in general. I wonder if you talk just a little bit about the project now and how its roots are in your earlier stuff and what you're expanding, so that people not only have a sense of what you're doing now and what to look forward to, but also have a sense of how the debates within the comic art form is also connected to the visual communication debates in general.
Well, you know, one of the nice things about understanding comics is that when it came out in 1993, it was specifically about comics, and it was for comics readers and comics artists. But very quickly, I started hearing from people in other fields. I heard from interface designers, from game designers, from people who made diagrams and maps, even from people in other art forms like theater. Many of them found the ideas in understanding comics useful, because by drilling down so thoroughly into one specific art form, I had somehow hit the bedrock of foundational ideas for all art forms. So that idea of universal ideas of design was very compelling early on. And I started to get very interested in those other fields as well. And over the years, I've developed more of a keen eye for, you know, information graphics, data visualizations, educational animation, signage, all of those things. And I found that a lot of them were grappling with a lot of the same challenges. And many of them had some of the same weaknesses as well. Many of them were violating certain fundamental principles of design. But each field seemed to be trying to reinvent the wheel. Each of them seemed to be, you know, barking up their own little tree, but not necessarily recognizing to what degree their challenges were universal challenges. So I thought it might be useful to put together a book where I revisit those basic principles of visual communication as applicable to many different disciplines. And so that's what I started working on. But so, in other words, I started with something very specific with understanding comics. I found that it had universal applications, and now I'm heading straight into that universal design arena and seeing if I have anything useful to say about how visual communication works generally.
Well, I can't imagine you don't. The experience of reading your work is tremendously interesting, and I encourage the listeners. Understanding Comics, which is the first of two books, is, I think, a must-read for anybody, for anyone who wants to understand the art form, for anyone who wants to revisit these questions that they didn't know that they were interested in asking. And then you have for lack of a better term, a sequel called Making Comics, which is takes those same principles and applies it to people who are interested in the structure and developing, in theory at least, their own comics. They're incredibly accessible. They're fun. They're interesting. They're wonderful to look at. And I learned –
We should say, Jack, that they're comics as well.
They're comics. I get to see lots of stylized pictures of you. And you have a great Flash t-shirt that you're wearing throughout Understanding Comics. And I learned more. I mean, they're philosophy books, and I learned more about comics. It's not simply that I learned more about comics from Understanding Comics than I learned from anything else. It's that what it allowed to do in an incredibly helpful way for me is solidify, articulate, and systematize everything that I learned about comics but didn't know how to organize in my own brain. And so it wasn't like someone was just telling me this stuff. It was tying it in with this lifetime of in and out into this field. So I encourage everyone to get a copy of it. I'll have links on the webpage. I'll have links to your page on the webpage. And it's just been – it's just another example of how every field can be philosophical and sophisticated when you take it seriously. So Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Why. I loved the process of preparing for this, and I loved the conversation. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Jack. I had a great time. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scott McLeod and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We've been talking and asking about how to read a comic, and I will be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein, and we just finished a conversation with Scott McLeod, author of Understanding Comics and Making Comics, and the writer, artist, and creator of Zot, and so many other things. He actually wrote a comic for Google introducing the Chrome browser. Lots of things to explore if you are interested. This was an interesting episode for me because I'm the son of a visual artist. I'm the son of a painter, drawer. She's worked in installations. And I've spent my entire life surrounded by art and artists. And comics for me, while they were a personal experience, were always outside that category. It's not that I didn't know that the artists were artists, and it's not that I didn't know that the drawings could be considered art, and it's not even that I didn't have this deep love for some of them. It's that they were just a different category. And now that I've come back to comics as an older person, as someone who has fewer limitations and more comfortable with intellectual exploration, which I feel safe, but also honestly looking for some more fun in my life, I'm able to look at comics from a wholly different perspective. And that's what I tried to communicate in this episode. I tried to channel the discourse that's been in my own head about suddenly taking this thing that I thought was for kids, that deep down inside I knew was more, and bringing that out to say, okay, what happens when I take this seriously? What happens when I look at this not only with a philosopher's eye, but with an art lover's eye, with someone who loves being surrounded by art and misses being in an exciting, boundary-breaking art world where there are surprises around every corner or on every wall. And what I discovered, of course, was it was me. There was this whole conversation for years and years. There was this whole discussion. There are great artists that are recognized in the comics community. There are classic issues and important panels and great moments in time that anyone who knows the tradition and knows the history will be able to talk about the way that somebody talks about water lilies or Moby Dick. And it's not the art form that was lacking, and it was not the community of comic artists or lovers that were lacking. It was me, and it was the culture that takes this thing that they think of as this commercial package for kid and does everything they can to denigrate it, does everything they can to diminish it, not say it stinks because then people would fight back, but just to say it's unimportant, it's irrelevant, and that's just wrong. The more you look at the history of comics, the more you see that it is an incredibly powerful social and political force, but even more so, it's an incredibly important and powerful aesthetic force. It is an art form in itself. And like all art forms, it is as deep as you want it to be, and it will reveal as much as you ask it to reveal. Like all art, it gives you what you give it. Give comics the time of day. Spend a little time examining, looking, asking, following some threads. It will be rewarding. In the end, it may not be the art form that interests you, just like some people don't like opera and some people don't like country music and some people don't like non-traditional texts like James Joyce's Ulysses. That's a personal preference. But there's a difference between saying, it's not for me and it's not art. And if there's anything that I want to communicate today, and Scott McCloud does it better than me, is it is art, whether you recognize it or not. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Thank you for listening. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.